Hello, my friends. This is Dr. Beter. Today is January 24, 1977, and this is my monthly audio letter number 20. Just 4 days ago, on January 20, 1977, our nation witnessed the crowning achievement of Rockefeller public relations propaganda, the so-called People's Inaugural of Jimmy Carter. Through emotional appeals to the American dream, millions of Americans are being enticed to let their hopes soar based on nothing but blind trust. But the most crushing disappointments are always those which follow the brightest hopes and the false hopes that are being raised by Jimmy Carter will come crashing to the ground all too soon. Even so, there is something to be thankful for that deserves a moment's reflection. Nelson Rockefeller still has been denied the goal he has sought for so long, seizure of the presidency and his establishment as America's first openly visible dictator. Never before has a bright light been focused on the real plans and actions of Nelson Rockefeller and his brothers. But now, after developing a total of 9 scenarios and backup plans for placing himself in the Oval Office through the back door of his 25th Amendment, he has run through them all. And for the moment, he has failed. Major factors that have upset and delayed the plans of the 4 Rockefeller brothers for total control have included such things as the twin gold and plutonium scandal at Fort Knox, which is still being covered up, Indira Gandhi's crackdown on the CIA in the summer of 1975, and of course their double cross by the Soviet Union that began last summer with the planting of underwater nuclear missiles along our shores. And according to my own intelligence sources, the glare of the truth has played an important role in keeping Nelson Rockefeller out of the presidency so far. In recent weeks, support for the leadership of the 4 Rockefeller brothers among their corporate socialist allies has been weakened by the shock of the Soviet double cross. Nelson finally abandoned his 9th takeover scenario involving the Electoral College scheme under pressure from Brother David. Thus, David Rockefeller, the most powerful of the 4 brothers, is now playing the role that their late Uncle Winthrop Aldrich always used to play in seeing to it that Nelson never became president. What Nelson Rockefeller may do from this point onward remains to be seen. Only one thing is for sure. Like the Soviets, he never gives up. And he has not given up on his dream of becoming the president and dictator of the United States and ultimately of the world. But for the time being, it is his brother David who is now president by proxy through his control of Jimmy Carter. What we are witnessing in the transition from the Ford to the Carter administration is nothing more than a changing of shifts in the one real political party that runs America, the Rockefeller Party. The Soviet Union is run decade after decade by fewer than 1% who belong to the ruling Communist Party. And the United States of America is now run decade after decade by fewer than 1% who belong to the ruling Rockefeller Party, whether they call themselves Republicans, Democrats, liberals, or conservatives. Jimmy Carter, who campaigned as a Washington outsider, owes his come-from-nowhere election to the fact that David Rockefeller selected him some years ago as the ideal puppet for his purposes. Carter was invited to join David's trilateral commission and was then steeped in trilateralist thinking, in other words, the Rockefeller line. With such powerful support, Carter has no idea how dangerous a position he is now in. Already, A Carter Watergate is brewing to cut him down. And worst of all, the threat of war hangs over everything he does. In his inaugural address, Carter expressed a preoccupation with war. And for the past several weeks, the American public has been under an avalanche of warnings about the Soviet military threat, including statements that the Soviets are now preparing for war. This is a complete turnabout from the virtual ban on anti-Soviet news that was enforced in the controlled major media until very recently. And the excuse that has been provided for all these new warnings is a new study of intelligence information that was launched last summer as soon as it was learned that the Soviet Union was planting offensive missiles in our waters. The threat of war, my friends, is very real. But the intent of the controlled major media in relaying these warnings to you now is another matter. We are now being psychologically conditioned to accept a declaration of national emergency when the time is ripe, and to submit to the dictatorial controls it will impose. The drive to merge the United States with the Soviet Union to form an all-powerful world government has already cost us 2 world wars, plus Korea and Vietnam. Now, we are once again in a pre-war situation on the brink of nuclear war one. And for reasons I can now reveal, the 4 Rockefeller brothers still believe they can succeed in bending the coming nuclear war to their own purposes. My 3 special topics for today are: topic number 1, Henry Ford's parting criticism of the largest foundation in the world; topic number 2, the current pre-war hostilities that are leading up to nuclear war one; and topic number 3, the great secret race in super weapons. Topic number 1. 1 year ago, in monthly audio letter number 8, I publicly revealed for the very first time the super-secret White House merge directive. Under this directive, our lives in America are to be so altered that we can be comfortably merged with the Soviet Union. And since last spring, I have also been drawing your attention to the little-known but central role that the major tax-free foundations have played for 2 generations and more to push our nation in the same direction. Last month, I was able to reveal one of my sources of information about the foundations, my friend Mr. Norman Dodd, and to repeat for you his own words about the clandestine role they have played in progressively destroying the America that was created by our founding fathers. Mr. Dodd's story is incredible, but it is also based upon painstaking, carefully documented research which he directed for the Congress of the United States. As one of America's foremost authorities on foundations, Norman Dodd is a man whose words carry a great deal of weight. But since last April, I have also been informing you that there is a contingent among the present-day trustees of these foundations who are becoming increasingly worried about the direction in which they are taking us. Even before the Soviet underwater missile crisis materialized last summer, their fears of a Soviet double-cross were mounting rapidly. And now, no less than Henry Ford II has resigned in dissatisfaction as a trustee of the biggest foundation in the world, the Ford Foundation. And he has warned in a criticizing letter that a change in direction would be wise to consider. In his resignation letter of January 11, 1977, he said in part, and I quote, "The foundation exists and thrives on the fruits of our economic system. The dividends of competitive enterprise make it all possible. A significant portion of the abundance created by United States business enables the foundation and like institutions to carry on their work. In effect, the foundation is a creature of capitalism, a statement that I'm sure would be shocking to many professional staff people in the field of philanthropy. It is hard to discern recognition of this fact in anything the foundation does. It is even more difficult to find an understanding of this in many of the institutions, particularly the universities, that are the beneficiaries of the foundation's grant programs, unquote. Shortly thereafter, he continues, and I quote, "I'm just suggesting to the trustees and the staff that the system that makes the foundation possible very probably is worth preserving. Perhaps it's time for the trustees and staff to examine the question of our obligations to our economic system and to consider how the foundation, as one of the system's most prominent offspring, might act most wisely to strengthen and improve its progenitor." Unquote. If you're not aware of the concerted drive toward collectivism that has been promoted for decades by the major foundations, these words of Henry Ford II may surprise you. Even so, you may be even more surprised at the reactions of the major foundations to his criticisms. Almost universally, their bitterest reactions had to do with Ford's defense of free competitive enterprise. For example, consider the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. In audio letter number 19 last month, you heard of the chilling role the Carnegie Endowment has played since 1909 in altering America's national life through warfare and twisting our education. When a high official of the Carnegie Endowment was asked for his comments on Henry Ford's letter of resignation, he reacted in the scornful words, "Is that what the Ford Foundation is set up for? To promote free enterprise?" Unquote. He was very upset at the mention of free enterprise, the indispensable foundation of freedom itself. Henry Ford II is not alone. Those foundation trustees who insist upon continuing the suicidal drive toward collectivism under the long-time commitment for a one-world government are trying to put down all dissent within their ranks. But Henry Ford II has courageously shown the way, and we can hope for others to follow. Topic number two. In all the major wars of this century involving the United States, undeclared warfare has been a consistent pattern. In the cases of Korea and Vietnam, in fact, the entire wars were undeclared. In the cases of World Wars I and II, undeclared warfare and provocations preceded the formal outbreak of war and marked the time period in each case that has since been called pre-war. In that sense, we are now living in the pre-war days that are leading up to Nuclear War I here in America. But as we are living out the days of the pre-Nuclear War I period, undeclared hostilities have reached a level unparalleled in the past. Consider first the repeated plutonium cloud attacks which have been mounted on the United States by Soviet submarines in recent months. As I've related in previous monthly audio letters, the first such attack was mounted in early October 1976 by Soviet submarines deployed along the Atlantic, Pacific, and Gulf coasts of the United States. Based on the results from that first full-scale experiment on our country, Soviet chemical warfare specialists concluded that subsequent plutonium cloud attacks could be mounted most efficiently from stations along the northwest coast. In late November 1976, a second experimental attack was mounted to test this out. And while it was not completely successful from the Soviet viewpoint, it provided all the additional data they needed. Both of these experimental plutonium cloud attacks by the Soviet Union were accompanied by convenient cover announcements by the United States Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, to the effect that radioactive clouds from Chinese nuclear blasts would be passing over us. Thus, an explanation was readily available should something unexpectedly severe happen, but it did not. And on December 13, 1976, as I reported last month, 21 Soviet submarines loaded with plutonium poison to inject into our atmosphere arrived on station along the northwest coast of the United States. This time, my friends, experimentation was no longer the goal. Certain individuals in the United States government knew they were there and knew why, but did nothing whatsoever to interfere with their mission. As of December 31, 1976, 13 of the 21 subs had emptied their load into our atmosphere and headed out to sea, having timed their attack to make optimum use of severe winter storm conditions across the United States. The other 8 subs remained behind to reinforce the main plutonium cloud by continuing to feed it periodically over a period of days. Finally, on January 3, 1977, these 8 Soviet subs also departed out to sea, having emptied their loads into our atmosphere. According to my own intelligence sources, this third and latest plutonium cloud attack by the Soviet Union was very effective. The Soviets did achieve a very broad dispersal of the plutonium poison throughout the continental United States. This, on top of the record cold weather blanketing most of the United States lately, may well lead to an outbreak of flu-like sicknesses in the near future, to which the government has been conditioning us now for nearly a year. Undeclared warfare by the Soviet Union is also continuing by means of the short-range underwater launch missiles, which have been planted in our waters by the Soviet Union ready for use in a surprise attack. Last month, I revealed that 93 such missiles were in place in American waters, and I gave the navigational coordinates for 9 of them, which were surrounding the island of Oahu, where Pearl Harbor is located. I can now report that the United States Navy did remove all 9 of these missiles, completing the operation on December 31st, 1976. But 4 Soviet submarines were on hand to observe the complete missile removal operation by our Navy. And as of January 17, just 1 week ago, 2 new Soviet missiles were already in place, threatening Pearl Harbor again. In addition, 4 other Soviet missiles have been planted since I recorded monthly audio letter number 19 last month. 2 in Alaskan waters, the other 2 on the West Coast. This brings the total back up to 90 as of now. My disclosures last month demonstrated to certain persons that I am not bluffing, that the United States is indeed targeted by a massive new round of Soviet underwater nuclear missiles. But for the reasons I gave 2 months ago, in my monthly audio letter number 18 for November 1976, I do not intend to reveal the rest of the missile locations, merely to have them wasted in the deadly cat-and-mouse game now underway. Instead, my own intelligence sources have made it crystal clear that only public exposure of the truth about this whole deadly matter has any hope of stopping the coming war. For that reason, I have already launched efforts through a number of indirect channels which lie outside the Rockefeller sphere of control in an attempt to bring about this public exposure. If full-fledged war does come, my friends, America is in for a wide range of nasty military surprises. In certain areas, Soviet approaches to military technology are far different from our own, such as in the field of anti-submarine warfare. One field in which they are literally decades ahead of the United States is in the area of microwaves as they affect human beings. Since early December, the Soviet Union has been conducting a major experimental test program on a new satellite-based system that uses microwaves to directly affect the behavior of humans. The test victims, the crews of selected tankers and freighters in and near American waters. Soviet researchers discovered long ago that prolonged exposure to microwaves, even at intensities considered safe in the United States, can produce a long list of effects on people. These range from dizziness and irritability to emotional instability and alteration of brainwave patterns, as well as other effects. Starting from these findings, Soviet scientists have developed microwave bombardment techniques which have the basic effect of greatly reducing a person's capacity for exercising judgment and fully comprehending facts at his disposal. A person under such bombardment, in other words, is very prone to make mistakes, serious mistakes. On December 15, 1976, the Liberian tanker Argo Merchant went aground on the Nantucket Shoals off Cape Cod, and the resulting oil spill of 7.5 million gallons was the worst to date in American history. Many things were strange about the incident, such as the fact that the Nantucket Shoals are a very well-known navigational hazard, and the Argo Merchant was many miles off course. Hearings later revealed that the ship's navigational gear was not in proper condition, but strange behavior by the crew itself went unexplained. The Argo Merchant was then followed by a rash of tanker incidents in and near American waters. And in almost every case, errors of judgment were either primary or contributing factors. It was a bad month for the Coast Guard, but it was worst of all for the 38 nationalist Chinese crewmen of the tanker Grand Zenith, which was lost at sea off the New England coast with over 8 million gallons of heavy fuel oil aboard. On December 30, 1976, the Zenith reported its position as about 60 miles south of Yarmouth, Nova Scotia. It was never heard from again. Several days later, after the ship failed to arrive at its destination, the Coast Guard began a search for the missing ship. However, it was noticed that the last position reported by the Zenith was so far north of its planned course that it did not seem to make sense. As a result, the search was shifted to a seemingly more likely area far to the south of that location. The story of the Grand Zenith is a tragic one, my friends. But it might have been less tragic had the Coast Guard taken the last position report by the captain of the Grand Zenith more seriously and anchored search operations on that position. Because on January 7, 1977, I received intelligence information to the effect that the location of the sunken Grand Zenith was approximately 43 degrees 5 minutes north, 67 degrees 52 minutes west. Furthermore, my information indicated that as of that time, there were still survivors in the immediate vicinity of the sinking. It was urgent that this be brought to the attention of the Coast Guard without delay. The search had already been narrowed down to the wrong area, over 200 miles to the southeast of the correct position, based on the finding of two life jackets bearing the name Grand Zenith. I immediately contacted the J.F. Moran Company in Providence, Rhode Island, the ship's agent in New England, and gave them the information. They passed it on to the Coast Guard, But there it stopped. For days, I tried directly and indirectly to get someone to check out the location I had been given. On January 10th, I contacted the Coast Guard directly to see what had been done. I was informed that no attempt whatever had been made to check out my report, and that no attempt was going to be made. Instead, the same fruitless area 300 miles east of Cape Cod was searched day after day for a week with no hope whatsoever of finding the survivors. Meanwhile, I could not persuade the Coast Guard even to make a single flight over the actual site of the sinking in order to check out my report. The same information was also given to the Navy after the Coast Guard refused to investigate, and the Navy, too, refused to check it out. Had either the Navy or the Coast Guard checked the information I gave them about the Grand Zenith, they would have found it to be true, and that would have demonstrated to the public at large that my intelligence sources about matters like this are extremely accurate. My intelligence sources had hoped that this would be exactly the outcome of my relaying the life-saving information about the Grand Zenith. But, my friends, the truth has many enemies.